for 40 days.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. It's Wednesday, January the 24th, 2007. We're here in Room A and about to hear an information meeting discussing the idea of consumption taxes. Our chair will be here in just a minute. He is testifying currently in the House. And with that, I will go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Chair George. The only member of the committee present, Senator Monroe, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. Today, we will talk about this idea. Senator Deckert, Chair Deckert, wanted to explore all these different concepts with comes to taxation, and I'd have to say that this one sent us back to the books. I brought the book with me. This is The Theory of Public Finance. And just to say, what's the difference between consumption tax, sales tax, excise taxes, and so on. Interestingly enough, if you consult the index in the back of the book, you would say, and look for the word excise tax, it would say, see sales tax. So with that, we proceed. Some of this stuff is really easy to take with your morning coffee. Some of it you might want to wait for the afternoon, but I try to put some sound effect here where appropriate to just keep you awake. These are the things that we have in the morning. Some people like to take tobacco, but alcohol usually isn't.
We're in trouble if we start off with
that. Right. We'll talk also about telecommunications, that's telephone and communication taxes, fuel and late mile taxes, as transportation taxes, and finally, transient lodging tax. Quick thing that we will talk about in tobacco revenue, which actually we have three distinct sources of revenue coming from tobacco. People don't think of them that way, but there are cigarette taxes, other tobacco product taxes, and then finally the master settlement agreement. That's becoming a really big source in the last few years. Now, the cigarette tax rate in the state, this has started, the Oregon legislature started the taxing cigarettes in July 1st, 1966. That's when we levied 4 cents per pack at that time. And it went through different times and different increases until the about 28 cents in 89, and then in 96, Measure 44 probably brought the largest increase at that time and put it at 58 cents per pack. Now, after that, Measure 20 of 2002 added another 60 cents per peg for now. One thing that happened in the state of Oregon that usually does not happen in too many states, and people when they're doing surveys and stuff, they call us and get really surprised. You guys actually rolled back the cigarette tax 10 cents? So that was the bundle of Measure 30, if you remember. And that's how 10 cents went down on the cigarette tax. Now, state excise tax rates, of course, it seems like most states, all states, do tax tobacco and cigarettes. And if you look at that rate just as the excise tax itself, the tax on cigarette, you would find that Oregon is about number 16, $1.18 per pack. However, many states don't only levy that excise tax, they also use the sales tax mechanism on top of, or before actually sometimes. Mm-hmm. So if you put that picture, things change a little bit, then Oregon becomes on the 20th between all the states. Okay, now you see those, the ones that don't have the, what is that color, pink? Maroon?
Purple.
Purple, all right, good. The ones that without purple are the states that have only the excise tax component to them. Now, just to take a quick look at what 0506 cigarette tax revenue look like, they're $222 million. At least they're not 666, right? Only one third of that. And that's the way they're divided between the different programs that they are dedicated to in law. So 66% goes to the health plan, general fund gets 24. Local includes cities, counties, and elderly and disabled transportation programs. And two is, of course, tobacco use reduction account. And the distribution, You'll never find in the statutes cents or percentages in the distribution of the cigarette taxes. What you would have, first of all, is two layers. You'd have the 58 cents, and you won't even have it that way. You would have 25 mils per cigarette. And, of course, the mil is one-tenth of a cent. So you would have your first 58 cents permanent because it has been enacted by the legislature through the time and increased. And it is in this ORS. And then, of course, the 60 cents was the result of the Measure 20 of 2002. And both of these layers of taxation are divided differently. So the general fund, the health plan, TORA, and the locals get a different percentage with the 58, while the lion's share of the 60 cents that happened in 2002 was to the health plan.
Mm-hmm. I noticed back in 67 when we put the tax in, there was that local portion. Was that in other words, did we preempt them from raising a cigarette tax and then we gave them a share like we did with lottery? Is that the reason for that? And was that the difference when the 2002 tax was added that their share dropped on that one?
Actually, Mr. Chair, the funny thing is when cigarette taxes started in 1966, the intent was to reduce property taxes. So it was actually distributed to counties and cities, and 50% of that, 25% each. So the original intent of the cigarette tax was a reduction in the property tax. And that's probably how the distribution to locals have continued so on ever since that time. I wasn't there, but some people would think I was.
In kindergarten.
Yeah, well, yes. In the 10 cents that we sunsetted with Measure 30 was a primarily health plan amount. It was a 10 cents. And if you put the different segments together, that's what it used to be. Now, this is the distribution that we use to distribute the taxes. The forecast for cigarette taxes is an interesting one this time, not because of any extraordinary level of forecasting, but because for a long time we had taxes on cigarettes going down. Because there was always a secular reduction or going down in smoking since 1978. So to have a forecast on cigarettes going up or flat, that's different. Now, as you could see, the level of change as Measure 20 came in, all the amounts that 60 cents would produce only produced this much because the consumption is not that high. and the consumption goes down with the price. The interesting thing, of course, that with the measured 30, the 10 cents, it didn't bring it down that much. So those are always things that the economists find really interesting to look at.
So we're down to the hardcore smoker now.
It seems that way, yes. 468 and 472 is what we expect for those taxes. Did that wake you up? Cigarette consumption. The consumption of cigarettes has, as I was just saying, in 1978 was where you had the highest level of consumption in the United States. That's also true almost everywhere in the States. We had a higher level at a certain other times, but that's probably not the main course of consumption that you would see everywhere else. Washington State had a little higher but in the beginning of the 80s. But for the most part, 79, 78 was the peak of smoking. And then all the trends turned down and they started going down. Interestingly, of course, you'd see in this time frame, Oregon was above the national average. And it caught up with the national average most of the 80s and 90s, and now it is below. Washington has always been below the national average. Now, that does not mean they smoke any less than Oregonians do or than what we do. What it means is, remember, these are the consumption that we could deduce out of taxation. Okay, for the state. If there is a stream of cigarettes that is outside the taxation stream, and Washington has a lot more independent tribes who are into the business of tobacco and smoking and so on. That is not showing in those.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
That little. Can we go back to that graph?
Sure.
I wondered if that peak there in Washington had anything to do with Canadian cigarette taxes jumping at about that time, jumping significantly, and of our good friends in British Columbia sneaking across the border and buying cheaper cigarettes in Washington.
Senator Monroe, I have no doubt that this will always be an impact. It seems like every time neighboring states have different price structure, consumption into the places where they're, and there's proximate population centers on the borders that are able to easily go and purchase in different places. And we will see this down with Oregon and Washington.
Exactly. You're seeing Oregon's consumption apparently being trending upward, but that also parallels the state of Washington having among the highest cigarette taxes in the nation, and it might be those folks sneaking across the border and filling their vans with cheaper Oregon cigarettes.
And this is where you would see this trend. You would see our population going up, and that trend all the time going down, and now all of a sudden here we're looking at a different trend altogether, and it is flat, or saying it's not, but it's not declining. And the interesting thing, of course, at this time frame here, when we were looking at the highest, we were smoking about 155 packs per person per year. This time frame. Nowadays, we're looking at about 54. Packs per person per year.
Do you have numbers on the percentage of Oregonians that actually smoke?
Senator Monroe, I think we have an idea, we have surveys, and the percentage have for at the beginning of the time here, we were looking at upper 30s, so 38-39%. Now we're looking at about in the low 20s, 21-22%. It will be when it falls below the 20 mark, then it becomes a big landmark, if you will.
Okay.
Well, that in essence, remember the drop from here to this point is about 66% in per capita. However, the volume is only 55%, and that is explained by the population increase. So the if we look at prices for cigarettes, when you compare them to the general prices of CPI, you see at this time here the CPI was going faster and ahead of prices of cigarettes. That relation kind of evened out a little bit in the beginning of the 80s, and as inflation continued going on this steady pace, you would see a skyrocketing price increases. This included all different mechanisms, not only the price of tobacco itself, but taxes and so on. That so this is inclusive of all your taxation. It's about 30% in different places. Different places, different states have more. But in Oregon, you're talking about 31%, 32%.
Listen, I've heard that the number is actually there. That there are certain brands that price out at about 25 cents a pack for the actual cigarettes. Have you heard any number that low?
25 cents per pack? As a price.
As the actual cost of the product.
Wholesale cost?
Probably wholesale cost, I'm sure.
Well, that could very well be. I mean, the places where they produce them, they tax very low. Now, remember, in addition to the state tax, there's federal taxes. And if you actually think about export, and there's an export tax, or the export deductions of tax, on the breaks and so on, and if you take all these taxations mechanism and all the different price, you might get low. I don't know if it's 25 cents, but I remember when a pack of cigarettes cost 25 cents.
That's right.
Do we have any demographic information about what your typical cigarette
smoker is? We do. I don't have it right here, but we do have... it is that always it has been. Where is the idea of the price increases seems to have the most effect with the demographics that don't make too much money. Let's say youth. Youth doesn't have income that is steady. And doesn't have necessarily an ability to keep spending all these amounts. So the higher the prices that we've seen with time, the less there is a long-term smoking, because it seems like if you don't start young, you have difficulty starting with time. And that percentage shrinks with time. But we have a lot more detailed outlook of when and who is smoking, and
yeah, I'd be interested in that information at some point.
Some of the small AM/PM type grocery stores near high schools have taken to selling cigarettes by the cigarette instead of a pack, because the kids can't afford a whole pack. They'll come in and plop down 25 cents or whatever for one cigarette. Of course, they're not supposed to sell them cigarettes at all if they're under 18, but we all know they do.
And Senator, I think you always hear of the state police and so on going through with these raids on places that. So that also pushes down on that population demographics of the youth.
I know there are studies out of Europe where the taxes have gone even higher than any state. And where the price of cigarettes has skyrocketed, that show a dramatic drop-off in the number of young people that are starting to smoke because it's so price-sensitive. So it does have an effect.
Price makes a difference. If anything that we got right in economics is that price works.
On the balance of that, I would be worried if the price of a marijuana cigarette and the price of a cigarette got close together.
Well, substitutes also work. That's also a price mechanism. Now, if you look at price, and that's, I put the graphs of U.S. average retail in Washington and Oregon. And you remember how we looked at Washington being the lowest in consumption. It's not surprising then to see Washington is the highest in price. And it just folds that Oregon is in between what it was, about the same average right here, started departing and going above the U.S. average in time.
Does that price include sales taxes in Washington and in the U.S.?
Yes.
But not, of course, not in Oregon because we have no sales tax.
Right.
Okay.
Now, one thing that when we talk about price and about increasing price, so if you increase taxes, that filters into the price. So basically, if you tax those amounts into a higher level, you would expect the consumption to go down by that much. The way we look at elasticity of price, we think that every time you increase price by about 10%, you would reduce consumption by about 6%.
Does that green line reflect the governor's recommendation?
That simulates some of the governor's recommendations, everything else being the same. However, if you look a different way, if you consider Washington's effect, and if you consider, for example, if Washington brings up its tax more, there is actually an uptick in our consumption because of the proximity of population centers. So you would see this blue type of line on the Washington effect. Now, there is a Washington effect, in effect, if you will, that is going now. A third scenario would be, what would happen if you put both in the same place? And, of course, you would have this blue line in between. So an up effect and a down effect, it will kind of come down in the middle. But it's still more down than increase. The one thing that we are also learning and starting to discover, the idea is that Washington, in addition to the increases in prices, they have established all these new restrictions on smoking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only the price, but it's where you can smoke and how. So you would find that we are looking at an increased level of business in the Jefferson Beach area, if you will, where you would have bars attracting customers where they come smoke and drink and gamble and be merry. So that effect actually makes an impact on the level of business that is done across the border. And you would.
We could expect if we have a similar ban, then that it would negate that effect.
That's true, and that's where we
do that.
I understand that.
That's the line that we're looking at right here. Is basically if you have a similar ban as Washington does, you're to expect that revenue or tax or consumption to go down by that much.
Have we looked at the impact of that though? I mean, if we have restaurants and bars, and they're in, and we're impacting in a positive way. Use of lottery, you know, the sale of liquor and food, and if we ban that, has anybody tried to calculate what that cost is? I mean, we should be able to look to Washington State and say, okay, you within the restaurant system, bars and restaurants, we had a reduction of this much and went to Oregon. Do we have any way to measure that?
Chair, I think if the impact that we start looking at is significant to that point, what we would do is run it through OTIM. That's our Oregon tax incidence model, to see if there is actually an impact on employment, personal income, and which segments of the employment picture does it impact. That's the way that we would be able to look at if we're looking at all-inclusive type, and if it's significant, that it merits running the OTIM on it.
The reason I ask that question is my son lives in an area in Texas that's dry, and a nearby county is wet. And he said, don't get on that road on a Friday night because, you know, these people are going to spend that money in that nearby county. And and I asked him, I said, what do you think it is? And he said, I would think it's probably, you know, 10 or 15% based on just watching the traffic and if you drive through there to see where they are, which is surrounding liquor stores and bars and stuff like that. So, you know, people will make a decision. If they're going to do it, they're going to do it somewhere.
And this is a different son, Senator George, than...
Yes, okay. We're everywhere.
Yeah, okay.
And he's politically active.
Yeah, is he in the legislature in Texas?
No.
Oh, okay. Just want to make sure. Okay, and we have, if you combine, let's say, bans and taxes, you would get even lower in consumption. Now, we've run through a lot of... So this was up here, the one with bans, right? And this would be the combined, both increased tax and bans.
Yeah.
Right. So it is further down. So in conclusion, if you put all these things together, this is the picture that we in the Legislative Revenue Office have to sort from before we get to a point of what does an increase in the cigarette tax impact and how does it impact our...
Now, the governor's recommendation is that our excise tax would equal that in the state of Washington, but isn't it true that Washington still has a sales tax on top of their excise tax, so the cost of cigarettes in Washington would still be a little bit higher than in Oregon?
Well, that's true, Senator Monroe, but however that starts basically relieving the advantage, if you will, if there is one, for the Oregon cigarettes from mm-hmm. Washington's. So sometimes it doesn't have to be equal 100%, but remember there's a cost of moving and going from one place to another, and yeah. Whether it's enough worth the gas that you spend, if you will. Or
undoubtedly there would be a lot less smuggling from Oregon to Washington than there currently is.
I can't testify to the smuggling, sir.
it's actually illegal for them to come down and fill up their van with boxes of cartons of cigarettes. But
two cartons.
We know what happens. So it's probably true that although it looks like there's been a bit of an increase in smoking in Oregon, that maybe Oregonians really aren't smoking more, that they're just, a lot of those cigarettes are going up to Washington.
Or people coming here and smoking.
Mm. I'm interested also in the issue of whether you allow smoking in bars and taverns or not. And you're indicating that there may be some Washington, Vancouver type folks that like to smoke and drink both, that may be coming across the border to bars near the border, near the Interstate Bridge, for example, Hayden Island area, because they can smoke and drink at the same time.
And play lottery.
And mm-hmm.
play line games.
Mm-hmm. That was my question about Ripner.
But,
or they drive a little further south to the bowling alley where they can bowl and smoke at the same time.
Bowl and smoke at the same time, yeah.
What
I think, what the restaurants found out when I I authored the Indoor Clean Air Act in 1981, which took effect in 1983, and the restaurant associations opposed it. And what they found out was that it did not hurt their business. It, in many instances, it increased their business because a lot of people are very sensitive to tobacco smoke and simply wouldn't go and eat at a restaurant where it was smoky, and increased the their eating out habits when that law went into effect. And the same thing may be true. Some people that are allergic to tobacco or really bothered by tobacco smoke still like to drink. And so I think the bars and taverns might find out that it probably doesn't hurt their business either, although there is somewhat of a correlation between people that drink at least in excess and people who smoke. But it's not complete, and you know, a lot of people like to go out to a bar or a tavern or a nightclub and enjoy the music and drink, but don't like the smoke.
Tastes are definitely varies between people, but I would think the cigarette consumption in Oregon, where you were buying in Oregon and paying the tax in Oregon, loses, if you will, the advantage
sure.
that it was offered to it, and that's
undoubtedly.
Yeah. And if you're interested, Senator Monroe, we could allocate certain level of budget. I could do this research on my own if you would like. I'll go drink in all these places and just make it.
Check it out.
Yeah.
If you're on the payroll, don't drive.
I'll report back to you next session. Now, the other tobacco products, as you know, are cigars, stogies, snuff, chewing tobacco, roll your own, and it seems that we have only bothered with doing the taxation on it only about twice. And in 2001, we put a cigar limit at a 50 cents each. Now, there's also different types of things coming all the time to the market. Now, there's the smokeless tobacco. And now, if there's those hookah bars, have you seen those popping all over the place? In your district, Senator, there's plenty of those. I had to do personal research on those myself, and I found just to see which kinds we. That's a personal research I'm offering to you.
I appreciate that. You're very committed to your job. That's the kind of commitment we like to see.
The graph you had up there, the 1985 law. I was chairman of the Revenue Committee at that time, and we were trying to equalize other tobacco products, chew and cigars and things with the tax on cigarettes. Yeah.
Now the tax on cigars, that's how they it looks because of that 50 cents limit. Remember the 65% out of wholesale price, it runs at around 90 cents per cigar. So if any cigar is 90 cents in a wholesale, it has a 50 cents per cigar limit. So it caps it, basically.
Dumb law. Sorry.
OTP revenue is not that big, actually. It's only about $31.2 million. However, it is have gotten much bigger than it used to be. It used to be about 25-something. With the, if you remember the enforcement law, tobacco enforcement provisions that were in the law in the last biennium, or the three bienniums ago, has actually brought up a lot of taxation that were lost during that time. Most of the other tobacco goes to the health plan, as you'd see in the general fund. Reduction accounts, and here's the administration and tobacco task force. So if you put
how is chew tobacco taxed or tobacco
65 cents per 65% of wholesale price.
So that's for chew or for pipe tobacco.
Right. Or
roll your own.
Or the new food flavored tobacco that I was
examined. And the hookah that you so aptly researched for us.
It's also very prevalent in Washington County. I think they
should see that photo.
Oh, the research photo?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did some personal research, Mr. Chair and Senator Byrd, about the new hookah bar.
I saw the picture and the letters UA came to mind.
Right. Urinary analysis. These new bars. So you see them around town with them.
They're popping all over the place, and they're very popular. They started basically in Las Vegas, and they started popping in San Francisco.
With the fruit-flavored tobacco?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what's the appeal of fruit-flavored tobacco?
I think you should do personal research.
I'd be back to two packs a day again. I'm not going there.
Smoke an orange.
So if you put total tobacco revenue together, you would end up with a picture like this, where the general fund is finally gets a reducing amounts. This is the health plan, and then you have the reduction account, the transit, and cities and counties. And you could basically see where the different times that we increased taxes and how they affect with the escalation. And remember, this is the time when Washington increase their taxes. We were going down after the hour 2002, and it starts picking back up again.
Because they're buying here.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, Master Settlement Agreement, you're all probably very familiar with it. It's 47 states that sued the different tobacco, the four tobacco manufacturers, four original ones, what they call participating and non-participating, and subsequent participation, annual payments in perpetuity, and then you would have estimated payments of billions of dollars, $8.8 billion, with about $257 million to start with in Oregon, going down with time and to stabilize at about $90-95 million per year. Now with Oregon, and remember the original agreement had the participating and non-participating, and the original agreement said that the states who get into the MSA need to enforce and protect the participating from the other companies that would come in under the radar screen, if you will, and grab market share. Last summer, the conclusion was that these participating manufacturers are losing market share to the non, and therefore subsequently they decided to reduce some of the payments. Oregon share of that reduction is about $14.5 million, $15 million a year. That is not necessarily being bought in completely as is, and there is litigation in process in order to bring back those amounts.
We're just talking without even going through the chair.
Back in 2003, I remember there was this issue came up of the non-participating versus the participating. And we passed a bill that the small tobacco companies opposed. I can't remember the details of the bill, but it was intended to remove some of this advantage. Does that sound familiar?
It does, Senator, and I think that's why the Attorney General is going with very strong countersuit on this, because he said we have the laws and we're enforcing the laws and we're dedicating a certain level of funding for those in order to fund the enforcement laws. Thus, we don't expect to be just treated in the same way that a state that did not enforce the laws or produce new laws. Some of these payments are not completely being taken away. They're putting in an escrow account in case it's judged in our favor, so that those amounts will come back.
We have a bill in our committee too that will at least deal with part of that question in terms of collection, big companies versus small companies.
Yeah, I never thought I would see the day when I would come to the aid of big tobacco. Never thought it would happen.
Speak a little closer to the mic.
It's no secret. I carried the bill.
Oh, good. Okay, we'll tee that one up.
And if you remember in 2002, was it the fifth special session? When we did the appropriation bonds out of the tobacco settlements for the education appropriation bonds, Oregon appropriation bonds, that we, when the budget had a hiccup at that time, we needed to give it some support.
Well, let me ask the chair here a question. Is the plan of that bill to go in and raise taxes on those exempt producers if, in fact, that balance gets out of proportion?
Okay, so I'm going to look back at our Department of Revenue, because I believe it's a Department of Revenue bill. My understanding is that the bill is designed around who is in terms of collections and who is out. And it's a germane question because of the whole, the increase in the healthy kids. Are you going to get that increase? And who are we collecting from? And how do you get those who are not participating either in or out of business? And or is my understanding of the bill. I don't think it deals with the taxes.
Okay.
Now, one of the factors I remember that we considered in 2003 is some of these small companies, they produce such products as chocolate-flavored cigarettes, they call them single stick cigarettes that they put on display in convenience stores. Now, guess what the market would be for something like that? And that was what one of the factors that swayed us in terms of basically stepping on their air hose in this bill.
Do they still sell clove cigarettes?
I think they do.
I smell them every once in a while. If you're walking, you can smell them. Excuse me.
So I always thought clove cigarettes were cloves, but they're tobacco with just clove flavoring. And they sell them on the internet.
Now we change. I tried to change all background on this. So if you remember, this was green and kind of thing. Now we're talking about a whole different ballgame. Alcoholic beverages. We've done the smoking, right? Let's go drinking now.
And Mazin volunteered to do some more research.
I'll take the wine.
Yeah,
to me,
I know you can stay away from that one.
Personal altruism and sacrifice from you. So that's the three different beer, wine, and spirits is what we tax in Oregon. And here we come again here. These are supposed to be party balloons. So that's where the beer tax rates come in. Remember, we've changed beer taxes about four times in our taxation history. We started in 1933 at $1 per barrel. Now, what does that mean? And we're back up here to about 8.83 cents per gallon, which is about $2.60 per barrel. Now, that's about 128 fluid ounces per gallon. So I try to bring it down to what kind of rate we're looking at. If you buy a six-pack, regular six-pack, we'll be paying about 4.7 cents. That's not much.
Per six-pack?
Per six-pack.
Hmm. 4.7 cents?
Yes.
Okay. And doesn't that put us dead last in the country?
Yeah. I'll show you a slide where we do. Now, if you, it'll be about, 0.786 of a cent of the rate. If you sip
that's your 16 ounce?
No, that would be your
12 ounce.
Mm-hmm. So if you are sipping your beer at the rate of 1 ounce and a half per sip, you would be paying about 0.098 of a cent, or almost one tenth of a cent, or a mil, if you will, a mil per sip.
first.
Those are very big sips.
These are really important statistics.
I thought people would want to know this.
I think half
that's
the mill
is... That's going to be a test on that. Little piece of factoid.
Sobering words.
This is the next question on you.
Although we will all repeat that. Next time we're all at like a bar or something, we will every single one of us will repeat that to whoever we're with.
One mill.
There goes another mill down.
Well,
down the hatch.
You would have to like be a lot.
Half is like a jigger.
Yeah, that's a big sip.
That's all.
Okay, it's a gulp.
That's all right.
Okay. So if you go to the question you asked Senator Burdick about what do we rank, we have about 48 if you only look at excise taxes. Okay. However, if you put both types of taxes, excise and sales, as many states do, that puts us 51 actually.
51st. There's only 50 states.
Well, there is District of Columbia, which is a taxing entity that we put on it. So that's where we end up. And that's 84 cents per hour.
Do Delaware and Montana have a beer industry?
Yes.
New Hampshire?
Well, Montana doesn't have sales tax.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And there's always this interesting, with Oregon, there's always this interesting, and beer, of course. Oregon and beer have two sub-groupings, if you will. The first grouping is the states that don't have sales tax, and where do we stand at between them? And the other grouping, the states that are beer producers, because we became a beer-producing state. If you look at these, we have not last, if you just... divide those out of the total. But if you add sales tax and excise tax, we'll always ending up last in every category.
Look at Wisconsin, and the excise tax is lower than ours.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a big beer producing
right.
state.
Mm-hmm. And of course,
Missouri.
Right.
Colorado.
The beer tax in general is not doesn't bring that much. It's about $7.02 million. Mostly goes to mental health at 50%, cities and counties. Now remember, beer tax revenue, it actually started ticking up, as you would see with time. That might or might not mean we're drinking more.
What is it in Washington? Quite a bit higher?
In Washington, it is quite a bit higher. Yes.
I mean, that's the same factor. We're sneaking across here and buying our cigarettes and our beer.
But we also have became the mecca of microbreweries, and we became a beer drinking state. Not only that we're drinking. Remember, we have a lot of people coming in, visitors. We became more of a state that caters to tourists and try to attract them and so on. And that is one part of our industry. Now, in 1987, or let's say 1990, we drank 23.67 per person per year, gallons per year. That's about 42 six-packs.
42 six-packs a person?
Per year.
Well, you guys are really drinking now.
That's in 1990. That's way back here.
Parkman on this committee, he would always get into.
Nowadays, it's even more.
Load on that.
What?
I said nowadays in 2006, it's a little more than that. It's about 41.26.
Holy moly!
If you boil it down to, here's the second trivia question that you'll ask you in your next cocktail party. How many beer bottles that means. If you remember that if you get those amounts per day, you will be drinking one beer per weekday, not including the weekends, per person. Now, not everybody drinks, of course, right? So in an average family of four, somebody might do the drinking for the other group. So you would be drinking 4 beers a day. The weekday.
So it probably is a small part of the population that is drinking. It's like video poker.
I know I do my part, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, good. We need the revenue.
Yeah. We'll wait till we get to the wine section.
Now, the wine, of course, is a whole different outlook to it.
I can come back on that before we that we're going to wine.
You want to go back to the beer?
If you think about that small amount of taxation, you know, 4 cents on a six-pack, there is no way we're even close to affecting the use of the product by having a tax increase on it. That really kind of shocks me that it's that low. And I've been through this before. I've just forgotten how low that tax was on beer.
4 cents a six-pack.
4.7 cents, almost 5 cents. But
that's less than a penny
a bottle.
If you're
in a Trailblazer game, it's $4, isn't it? Something like that. Or a little cup. Mm-hmm. $4.
Six.
Now,
$6?
Popeye Jam. I went to the Popeye Jam in December, and it was $6 for.
And the tax on that.
Maybe $7.
Was half a penny.
Yeah.
$6. Come on.
Now, remember, there's in the beer producing states, level of taxation on the product is low. However, the sales tax kicks in, so it's in a way it's not that uncommon for beer producing states not to tax their products too high, but I mean whether it is it absolutely needs to be number 51 is a whole.
I probably should be talking to ODOT safety, but of the number of people that we pop for DUIs or involved in accidents, you know, about half of our accident rate are people under the influence. I would imagine a pretty high percentage of that is beer that they are consuming.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Beer drinkers are more likely to drink to excess than wine drinkers. I spent 20 years on the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI and pick up some of this stuff. But yeah, beer is. Of course, if they can get it, the fortified beer, the ales, has a little higher alcohol content. You think that beer has lower alcohol content than wine, considerably much lower than hard stuff, but still, people that get drunk usually drink beer.
That's
really
amazing.
And dry.
Not microbrewery, right?
It's so filling. I can't imagine.
I'll sit in a cavern and drink a couple of pitchers.
Oh,
it's interesting. So it's not hard. I mean, in terms of DUI accidents, it tends to be beer as the culprit more.
Beer. Yep.
Oh,
let me darn.
These people give beer a bad name. Okay, so the verdict is your drown.
There's my homeland here.
And again, we started back in 33. At different times, we put taxes on the sweet wines or dessert wines. However, that did not always happen that way. But at this time, we have 67 cents per gallon for table wine and 77 cents per gallon for dessert wine.
Now, what do you mean by dessert wine?
Fortified wines.
That's more than 14%.
Not natural occurring alcohol, but it's been fortified, additional alcohol, and port.
Port.
Regular table wine is usually 11-12% alcohol, something like that.
Some of them are getting higher.
And that's the fortified then.
No, they're not. They're
it's up to 14% will be considered table.
Okay.
Between 14 and above, it's.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you make wine in the basement or something, it's going to come out somewhere around 11-12%.
And so would that fortified? Would that? Because I think isn't brandy a wine derivative thing?
Brandy is distilled wine.
Distilled.
So that'd be under the distilled spirit. So port would be covered, but not brandy.
So, if you like, I could, and I will later probably. So, if you have dollars per gallon, and you look at the different states,
and see what Oregon ranks between everybody else. We're about 24. That's about middle of the line. Last time we did this in the previous session, we were about 23. So we fell back one. Again, if you put sales tax on top of that and compare them, the picture changes again a little bit to go back, way back.
And where's California and Washington State?
And Washington is up, is right here. That's so our friend Washington. And California is right.
Mm-hmm. But both high sales taxes.
Right, and what about the previous
California
chart?
California is where most wine is produced.
Yeah.
Well, Washington is really growing. So where is Washington and California on this chart?
In this chart, you would have California right here.
Uh-huh.
And you would have the state of Washington disappearing from the map. Here it is. Mm-hmm. So we had, obviously California does not have too much because it's its own product that
right.
probably spend as much to promote it as to tax drinking.
It's interesting. Some people have said that alcoholic beverages ought to be taxed on their alcohol content. If you did that, look, there's 67 cents a gallon mm-hmm. for wine. 8 cents a gallon for beer. Beer is about half or maybe 40% of the alcohol content of wine. So if you equalize them, you know, beer would have to be raised from 8 cents to about 25 or 30 cents.
Or the wine tax to be reduced.
You could reduce the wine.
20.
Yeah, that would work too.
Okay.
We also have to raise taxes.
Now, the important thing is we're number 47. If you look at wine tax revenue, interesting that it is 777. Does it have any relation with Washington being a good producer of wine? And 777 with Boeing? It's just a coincidence. So the mental health gets 49%, and general fund 27%, cities and counties.
Are these breakup percentages between mental health and general fund, are they the statutory historical where it's gone, or is it somehow dedicated constitutionally, or
it's statutory.
So we do have flexibility, and we could change these percentages if we so chose.
Well, the cities the cities and counties, the cities, they had a different division between them before time. When the state came in, it preserved some of that formula. So about 12% of that happens that way. But, you know, the other stuff, mental health could, and general fund, 27%. Interesting thing, of course, when you have a kicker, when the general fund portion of wine tax and beer tax, you actually end up sending back the money of the wine and beer because you have a kicker. And you could, perceivably, probably didn't happen, end up with higher revenue amounts for beer and wine and distilled liquors, of course. And you're very high on the general fund portion, and that will put you over the threshold of the kicker, and you start sending back money, because it is the definition of what the general fund is.
But wait a second, is the wine part of the kicker, wine and beer part of the kicker, is that included in the overall income tax receipts?
Estimation of the general fund.
In other words, the wine portion itself doesn't have to go over 2%. It's
no.
wrapped into the
economist makes the projection and
about the wine tax or about
the total general fund. Here's what you're going to have for your general fund, and
mm-hmm.
if he or she misses
by 2%
with interest,
and 2% is thin enough
that
you would have conceivably it could be pushed by
any one of these things.
So the wine board part is it, the wine board part, that's for their marketing and everything.
Right.
Is that a separate tax?
It's it, well, in the statutes it is. Yes, it is a, set as this much of mills will go to the wine board.
That's for local product, right?
Well,
you don't
want to have a tax on something that would violate the Commerce Clause. So you're promoting wine, not necessarily local wines over. Otherwise, you would have you're taxing outside producers in order to benefit inside producers, and that's not kosher.
But why wouldn't we have a wine board if it wasn't to promote?
To promote wine.
That's what it does, yeah.
Promote wine.
Yeah.
And we love wine. And obviously, Senator Burdick is
really loves wine.
Is there any prohibition on the county saying, well, in addition to the 5% of the wine tax, we're going to levy a local tax in order to cover infrastructure costs from wine drinkers that are in the area? Do we have a limit on what taxes can be collected locally?
Well, if it's consumption, it might not, but however, I think it is part of the agreement when the state levied its tax is to have those amounts going to counties for the in lieu of.
And that's right. Can we check that to see whether or not
we could
if you're a wine, because you're a wine producer, which your district
right.
is,
mm-hmm.
you have all these people coming,
yep.
using your services.
It's stretching infrastructure badly without.
Or we're coming more now with all these new hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. When we build that commuter line down there, they're really going to come.
It goes right through the middle of it. Seven wineries on the rail.
Huh.
Or more.
Yeah? And if you look at.
You have the world's most perfect district.
I know.
If you look at the history of. There's this time when things went down and then leveled off and started taking. Back up here, and this is. You notice this is like Burgundy or Bordeaux for table wine, and this is Champagne for dessert wine.
Mm.
The colors are not a coincidence. I'm trying to say. Okay, we in 1987.
So wine consumption is somewhat. It is tracked somewhat with the economy, looks like, because that was a recession coming, right, where that little dip comes.
Have you priced a good bottle of wine lately?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on where you buy it, I guess.
Tax or no tax, it's expensive.
It is. Well, in 1987, we used to consume about 3.2 gallons per capita. Okay. Nowadays, and we went down. This is the 87. This is where the peak, and we started going down, and we're back up to about that much, 3.15.
3 gallons per person per year.
Yes. That's not much, I guess.
That's way below the beer.
Now. See that from the serenity of wine to party scene.
I like your graphics.
Yes. Let's liquor. Let's have a party. OLCC has a markup of, they don't levy a tax per se, but it's a markup. By definition, by law, it's or allowed for the commission to set that. And they do something like 106% supposedly, but it fluctuates depending on refunds and cost of goods and so on. But that's today. It's just revolves around this 100%.
Okay,
now, if you think wine is expensive, try a bottle of scotch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but a bottle of scotch lasts a lot longer.
That's true.
Well, it's essentially hard liquor is half tax.
That's correct.
Wow.
So if you look at the number of cases and the populations, that's how our population goes. And sales and cases go up with it. So we've been drinking.
Looks like it's increasing. Hard liquor is increasing.
Yeah, hard liquor is increasing. On about we're drinking about per person about half a case of, you know, 30 bottles a year per household.
Holy smokes!
Four people household.
Jeez.
Now, this may be a little political on this question, if I can ask this question, but these taxes seem to be not regressive. In other words, you're paying a markup. If it's a very expensive piece, you're going to double it. It's a very cheap piece of liquor, you know, like cheap vodka or something like that. You're going to, the markup is very minimal. So a lower income person may choose to buy, have a lower priced item and will pay a lower tax. But on the beer and the wine, because of the fact the way it's taxed, it's actually it's a regressive tax, the way I would read it. Is that correct? This is progressive on the basis of what you're willing to spend for it.
Because the higher the price of the bottle,
higher the price.
Because it's not a production tax. It's a
it's a consumption tax. Now remember, everything, the more you tax a product, the less consumption of it there is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you correlate lower income with lower drinking, then you could make the conclusion about being regressive, as you know, that the lower the income, the higher the tax.
Mm-hmm. On beer and wine.
No, not beer.
Well, I mean, it's whether it's regressive or.
Because
at
you're
4 cents, I mean, you almost feel like
so cheap,
at
you'd
4 cents.
You'd have to get real regressive.
I'm talking theory here. Because if it is a $6 bottle or a glass of beer at the ballgame, or a inexpensive bottle of beer that you bought at a Safeway or whatever, the tax is the same per gallon.
Well, the exception is sometimes what it says. Higher income people probably are more health conscious, so they might not be as heavy drinkers as lower income, which means that you're paying higher portion of your income in taxes at the lower level than when you're paying it at the higher level. Well, actually it wouldn't affect you that much anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you judge regressivity versus progressivity of the tax. How much of the tax is chewing into the income? Or percentage, because
mm-hmm.
if you have the same percentage, that's a flat tax. If you're paying $10 on your liquor taxes and you make $100,000 a year, and you pay $10 and you make $10,000 a year, that's obviously a regressive tax.
Mm-hmm.
How much does beer cost nowadays?
I don't buy it by the six pack, Mr. Chair. I buy only
like a grocery store. How much?
Oh, about it depends. Microbrewery is about $7-$8.
Well,
could be $9, $10.
Coors and Bud and the regular stuff.
Probably about a bottle would be
a rough
guess. Less. Grocery
store
for like a Coors, I would think.
So what you pay for soda?
Somebody told me once that beer was about almost the same price as Coke.
That's correct. Many times you'll see the per bottle, because I watch that just to see what are we encouraging people to do. Be cheaper to drink beer.
Talk to me. It's pretty good at
cost. Yes.
That's how much I know.
Now, all CC revenue, this is all revenue coming in into the system, that includes beer and wine, is about $345 million in 2005-06.
Wait, that includes beer and wine?
Yes.
I didn't think that was regulated through all CC.
It's amazing.
Is it?
It's amazing.
No.
Well, No, but the privilege.
Because it can be sold in stores.
Yeah,
but just a couple stores.
No, beer and wine.
Oh, beer and wine.
DC regulates like grocery stores and so on that sell beer and wine, but.
Yeah, you have to have a license.
Yeah.
So. But the cost of goods, especially for the inventory and so on, is about half of that. Net sales are about 33%. Operating expenses, 14%. Licenses, 1%. Now, once that is done, you have a distribution formula. This is how it comes. 2 cents of the wine tax goes to the wine board for the...
2 cents per bottle?
2 cents per gallon.
Per gallon.
And then the balance of the wine tax and the beer tax, after you take, you slice off these 2 cents, would go 50% to mental health, and 50% go into the OLCC division, the OLCC fund. Mm. And then you take that OLCC fund and divide it 56% to the general fund, 10 counties, 20 to cities by population, and this is the 14% to cities by formula that happened in lieu of the 1977 formula that they used to have. So the total would, after you take all the other stuff, would be about $390.7 million, or $140 million. All what you've been talking about is $140 million.
So they spend $200 million in operations. Its total revenue is $345.
It's about 50%.
We only get $140. Mm-hmm. So it's $200 million gets spent, and they
cost of goods is about 50%.
Okay.
Because
cost of the product and administration.
Trips and commission.
That would be interesting though to look at just how much. Just having one visit out at OLCC, I did not realize what a huge enterprise.
It is. It's a good to be a monopoly if you're the state, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Did you go in your warehouse?
No, I didn't.
Oh, God, the warehouse is unbelievable.
Has there been any recent studies just to compare, getting rid of OLCC and just having a more common market type system, how that would impact state revenues?
I think that has, Senator Stubb, almost every couple of sessions we look at that. And remember, the important thing is whether you're charging. I mean, if you're a monopoly and you're a state monopoly and you're charging the right price or the monopolistic price and getting all the profit, and then you have other policy goals that you're achieving, then you're doing fine. If you are charging a different price than where you should be. So the idea is whether you're charging the right price for the monopolistic enterprise that you are or not. And that's a fun thing for economists to do.
I'd be interested if there's any, a session ago or session before that, there was some kind of work that was done on kind of looking at the whole going to a market-based approach, kind of what that would do to state revenues. I'm not asking you to do something new, but if you can look back and pull something up, I'd be interested in seeing that.
So this doesn't look much different than what we've seen the other ones. It's all stuff's going back up again, and everything we seem to be the party state that we are.
Party state.
Now, the 9911. Well, is this sound effect working? Yes. Does it give the implication that it's an emergency access tax?
We were all incredibly startled there.
Yes. Well, we have a satellite here at least. satellite. That's an emergency access tax. And that's an 81 was a 3% access, 5% in 91. And then we made it at 75% per month per circuit, which means both landline and cellular.
So this just took off. I mean, this is the one that...
This is just took off. Exactly. You know,
what are they still... I've always thought bias here. They didn't expect this revenue.
$36 million
a year. Yeah, they just did not expect. No one expected because of the explosion in number of lines we all have and the tax we pay. Do you know, are they spending? They used to have huge surpluses, and I think once we noticed that, have they started spending those surpluses?
Is there an argument for a tax cut?
I'm open on this. Because no one expected that.
Mr. Chair, I could look into expenditure. Remember, we're revenue people. And we think at the beginning there was revenue. And how others spend it.
Well, I thought that they were supposed to be investing this in infrastructure improvements to get them all on the same wavelength and all that.
Well, there are, these, of course, are dedicated for the different emergency centers, 911 centers, and so on. However, there is an argument that says a lot of technology needs to be done, especially with the cellular phone coordination, triangulation of the signal, and so on. And this is probably part of the latest search and rescue stories that we've had, and whether that is working or not, and that kind of. So there is a lot of infrastructure needs for it. Now, whether it's enough or more than enough, but it keeps going, that is something that I'm sure the legislature has always the prerogative to look into.
If you look at $450+ million we're going to spend on four agencies wireless, this is a minor amount. But let me give the committee a little example of something we stumbled into last summer, and we had folks that were calling to report drug dealing and methamphetamine production, only to find out that the drug dealer was able to monitor our current 911 system, and they knew exactly who was going where. In other words, what jurisdiction, state police, county, because they're very sophisticated in the equipment they have to monitor. And the first question I ask is, wow, what do we do to digitize that where it would be at least more difficult to break? Because it was just very easy to have a cheap, inexpensive scanner that was monitoring 911 calls. And in fact, you could probably program a computer to pick up the word drugs or something like that and activate the voice on that. So, I think this is an area we want to be really careful if we look at taking any money away, because this is life and property that was at risk because of the fact that the drug dealers and manufacturers were alerted to a call coming in from a constituent.
I'll find you the money, senators, and you decide how you want to spend it.
Rob Patridge was working on that a few sessions ago.
Yes.
Just the growth of that pool of money.
Now, fuels taxes, is that like a highway, or does it work?
Like a river.
No, well, you know, so much you could do. How you...
After you did all that research, that's maybe how people drive.
That's effectively alcohol use.
Okay. Driving on. Gasoline taxes. Which are basically any fuel as defined in constitutional terms that will propel a motor vehicle. That is at 24 cents. Then you have aircraft. This is 9 cents per gallon for what's so-called avgas and 1 cent per gallon for jet fuel. Diesel, CNG. CNG is your compressed natural gas and others. Will also be used to propel motor vehicles at 24 cents. Diesel, however, the tax on it is not levied on the vehicles that pay weight mile tax. And those vehicles are the vehicles of 26,000 pounds and above. They pay the weight mile tax, of course. And they also have two more options, or one option to pay the flat fees for a certain class of trucks, and road use assessment fees are the fees on heavy vehicles. So motor vehicle fuel rates, I just put this quick history And of course there is more down here. And there is another piece of trivia for the next conversation that you have, which is which was the first state to levy a gas tax. It's our state.
Mm-hmm.
In which year that is?
1904.
Very good. 1919. Yes. Well, Senator Starr, you've all the service on the transportation.
Yeah, I'm going to bring that up at 1 today, but in our transportation.
And in 1905, actually, it was the first registration fee. So you were remembering one of those years. So you want more trivia things? However, remember, many of you are probably around or remember those beginning of the 90s, there was this 2 plus 2 plus 2 program. This is Access Oregon Highways at that time. It brought back highway funding, or the so-called the highway fund, back into what it was, stagnant for a while. I just put these amounts in real terms, and they used $2,000 just to show how, if you look at it in that way, the increase is not that big, except here. However, this amount of time, it's deceiving. It's 1968 until 1982. There was nothing. So, fuel tax revenue is, and remember the 2 plus 2 plus 2 program in the beginning of the late 80s, beginning 90s, have really brought some money into the state highway fund. And at this time it started stabilizing all the way up to here, and then interestingly enough we started growing back again. Now remember this time, 04-05, this is introduction, or 05-06, introduction of the hybrid vehicles into the fleet and more. Yet the SUV trend and the bigger engines and so on overtakes all that into more consumption and more revenue.
And a lot more cars.
Weight mile tax, remember, is there are two tables in the statutes that put weight mile tax into action. Table A, what's so called, which is trucks from 26,000 to 80,000 pounds. And 80,000 pound is what is known to be the B class of trucks. This is what you normally see. And those are taxed on graduated basis of weight per 26,000 pound per mile. And then you have table B, and table B deals with, and why you have table B, it deals between 80,000, 105, and 5. Remember, once you start getting from heavier weights, the impact or the footprint, if you will, of the truck on the road gets significantly accelerating. So at that time, table B, what would it do is graduate it and also give it different allowance for number of axles that you put on. So the more axles you put on, the lower your tax.
That was a very positive incentive, by the way, for adding axles.
Right.
Very good way to tax it. Mm.
In lieu of weight mile tax, flat fees offered for sand, gravel, and chip trucks. Road use assessment fees is for indivisible loads. Those are loads above a certain weight, 105.5, and you cannot divide them into different trucks. The spruce goose, you remember when they brought it down, up.
Some of the windmill, big windmill turbines, they can't divide them, and they weigh over the allowed limit. They can pay this fee.
Right. So that's how the table B looks. This is what you would have if you are doing all on table A. And once you start adding axles 6, 7, 8, and 9, your rate goes down. And this is a different amounts for the trucks, the road use assessment fees. It's 5.7 per easel. Easel is equivalent single axle load,
and is defined as 18,000 pounds for a single axle load.
ASHTO definition.
And the weight mile tax here it shows. Remember, every time you increase the fuel tax, you need to do something correspondingly to the weight mile tax. However, the weight mile tax is a lot more sensitive to economic conditions than the fuel tax. You could see how the dip here with the recession occurred with the weight mile tax. However, there was a reduction in rates a little bit, but this is I mean, shipping and moving goods around, if you are experiencing a recession, you could
use that as an indicator? I mean, could you look at the weight mile tax and try to look if you're seeing any slippage in it? And
absolutely.
Yeah. Do we
do
that?
Yes.
We do.
Okay. We do. The state economist does that, too.
Okay.
I remember when I was doing transportation forecasting,
you saw some...
We actually put that into their model.
Okay.
Can I back up? Mark, we have down here flat fees. The farm truck's $5 per hundredweight. What we're doing now is we're paying it in form of diesel tax. We pay the 24 cents on the unleaded, on the low sulfur diesel. Am I owing some tax I don't know about? Because that's what I understood we're doing. We're paying the 24 cents in lieu of any other tax.
Department, are you getting this? Department of Revenue?
I just paid them $1,500. Give me a break.
If you're filling from place at taxes on the pump, then you're paying the 24 cents. But it's not in lieu of. I mean, there is no relationship between the 24 cents and the flat fees in that sense. You could get a refund on your 24 cents and pay your flat fees, but that hasn't been an otherwise type of relationship.
So you pay one or the other, but not both.
Right, and it depends on your weight.
Yeah. The greater sum, okay.
Transient lodging tax, the thing changes to scenic.
Just a time check, Madison. We should try to jump through this one if we can.
Okay. How long do we have more?
Well, we got lottery, don't we, still?
Yes. Oh, that's quick. That's fun. Gambling.
That's right.
Yes.
Dale, are you doing lottery? Are you, Madison, you're doing lottery, too?
Yes, I'm doing lottery. Dale Penn, the director of lottery, we asked him to be here just in case you have any questions because of the lottery. I'm sure there's a lot of interest to many of you. We have this quick transit lodging tax. It's 1%. It funds tourism. The providers collect it and they keep 5%. 2% of the costs stay with the Department of Revenue. And basically, at the time we've done it, that's what we were expecting. This is how much we started collecting when it started late. 1.5 million. All five, we started getting 8.4 million. That's pretty good. As we also changed the law in the 2005 session, expanded it. Now we're getting 9.25 million. And this is still expanding. And remember, the transient lodging tax effective rate for all the cities or local governments, because they started this thing. Without the state on top, the layer on top of the 1%, the effective rate is about 7.7%. They are collecting about 77 million. That's about 10 million per cent. Mm. Right? So.
Not being a sales tax state, are we high? I mean, this is for Oregon, it's a way to tax others. Are we high, low? Do you know? Compared to.
Sure, I think we're average. I could look into more thing, but we're not unusual.
We're not high.
I am. Seems like this would be one you'd want to...
I had a conversation yesterday with Todd Davidson, and a statistic surprised me on this particular issue, is that 50% of the transit lodging tax is paid by Oregonians for vacation in Oregon. So let's...
Go into Hood River.
Yeah, it's just going to the coast or doing whatever you do. That's something I always thought, yeah, we're going to tackle these other people outside of the state, but we're going
to... I know in Portland they agreed to raise those to pay for the new convention center and the expansion of it. Because the lodging industry had reached that. In one of the convention centers, and then 15 years later, one was double the size of it.
Do we have a statewide rental car? I mean, rental car. At that point, you got to be at 90%. Is
that paid for? That also contributed. An increase in rental car tax also contributed to the convention center cost. Uh-huh. And again, it was voluntary from the industry.
Yeah.
My understanding, we're way below Washington State, though, when it comes to rental car tax. Because I was told that they use a lot of rental car tax to subsidize their commuter rail type operations.
Mr. Chair George, we don't have a rental car tax as a state. We have only Multnomah County does.
Okay, so Multnomah County.
Right.
Would it be possible to check to see how large that tax is in Washington? Apparently, that's a state tax.
It's not in Washington, yes. In Washington, it is a state tax. I think it was 9%, and we have.
If we tax 9%. Rental cars as a state in Oregon, wouldn't that be revenue have to be dedicated to the State Highway Trust Fund?
That has not been established. I mean, it's a good argument because it is a tax on the
it's
use
on a
of
vehicle,
a vehicle.
On a vehicle uses no, the roadway, just like your anything that you put into your car. Or anything.
Yeah, but registration.
Auto rental tax does not go to the highway fund.
What does not?
No.
At the county level?
Multnomah County's auto rental tax does not go to the highway fund.
Now, whether I think the question whether should it...
tourism and to build the convention center.
Right. But whether should it go to the highway fund, that's
well, if it's a state tax, that's interesting.
Even
why would it be different if it's a state tax or a local tax?
It could go to the state police fund in the highway.
You're way down.
Now, Senator Stubbs, it doesn't matter if it's a state tax or not.
Yeah,
any tax, whether it is local or state, that is on the operation, propulsion, or chauffeur license,
right.
Should be.
Yeah, Multnomah County has a 3-cent gas tax. Got to go to the highway and road, just like the dedicated state tax.
Right.
I was told that you're right, it wouldn't, but we'd probably have to have the court decide that.
Well,
hasn't been an issue. Nobody's brought it to.
Never been tested as far as
I know. People talked about it. I don't know if they asked either the Attorney General or the State Council about it. Since you want to transition to lottery, we call it the voluntary tax. People volunteer to pay taxes. Everybody, remember when people play lottery, they don't necessarily think of tax. What they think of is winning and having. Coffee and drinking, no.
The common theme in this is.
But you're also voluntary.
And we could also tax that too.
I call it a tax on being stupid.
Thomas Jefferson was an advocate of lottery tax.
Yeah.
He thought of it as such too. So we have our net proceeds, the transfers, and we have issues that we want to talk about. Terminology of revenue of the game, other revenue, which is interest and on amounts, and also unclaimed prizes. This is part of the revenue. There's plenty of those. Prizes, once you take the net receipts and you take prizes or game revenue out of prizes out of that, you would have net receipts, expenses of the game and the operation, so it's all the expenses that, and also part of the expenses is the contingency reserves and the commissions that are paid to retailers as part of the expenses. Once you take all these expenses out of the net receipts, you get net proceeds, and you would see those two definitions used different times between net receipts and net proceeds. So they're important to keep apart. The history of it, of course, you probably are all familiar with it, so I'm not going to go through it too much. But it was an initiative petition created and then introduced the Education Stability Fund at one time to use it for education. Today it is at 18% Education Stability Fund. net proceeds. Also, the 15% dedicated to parks, beaches, waterfronts, and so on. And the 5% general fund limit on the Education Stability Fund is something that just needs to be mentioned. Once it hits that 5%, the amounts of lottery from 18% stop coming to the Education Stability Fund and they go to the capital matching account at 15%, no, not 18%. So whether we will reach that soon enough or not is an issue for discussion. Now, the 2005, if you remember, last session, we repealed the sports action and all sports games and gave colleges 1% of net proceeds to college athletics.
That's so we can get the All-Star game in the Rose Quarter.
Got it. So the traditional lottery games, you would see that out of those what you otherwise expect, or I would have expected, it looks differently. This is the multi-state is the Powerball, the instant tickets are 32 and Keno 31. These are still the biggest drawers. This is only the traditional games, it's not including video. Megabucks, only 8%.
There we go.
123.6 million. That's how much traditional games brought. It's a dizzying effect. Okay. Traditional games, as you would see, that is. There's an increase, a dip, and then going back, and then the percentage of net revenue is changing with time. Traditional game revenue, if you look at it in percentage-wise, though, you'd see how net revenue has actually trended down. And that is a function of, you would think, expenses, but it's actually prizes.
What's causing the prizes to go up?
A family in Jacksonville winning $340 million.
Want to do it?
Maybe.
Sweeten the pot.
Maybe. Is that it, Dale? You just got to, the prize has got to be bigger so that you...
Well, when you pay out that much in one family in Oregon, I think that makes a difference.
It just jumps the...
Mr. Chairman, Dale Penn, Director of the Lottery. And prize points for games is a very difficult issue. What we're seeing nationally and certainly in Oregon, our traditional game sales are flattening and actually beginning to go down. And a lot of states have increased price points and increased their prize pools to attract people. It doesn't necessarily, it may increase your sales, doesn't necessarily increase your profit. Sure. But we are right now in a challenged area where our traditional game, except for Powerball, which has really increased dramatically the last 2 years, that going into the mix has increased our profits and really our sales dramatically, but the rest of the products have pretty much stabilized. So we're in the process of purchasing a new gaming system, traditional gaming system. So you see a little red box, that's how you would get a Megabucks or a Powerball ticket. It's 10 years old. And it is like, some of you may have heard me give this example, it's like a Commodore 64 versus a new computer. And so it's going to give us some capability, and we really need to do something to try to pump up those traditional games.
What is the total churn right now? I asked that question yesterday.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator George, on the video product, you really have about a 10-to-1 mix. And so I think the comment was made that we're showing a $10 billion and for a $1 billion kind of net amount. So it is about a 10 to 1.
Okay.
And it is a fantasy number. Those are credits on a machine. But if theoretically everyone cashed out as soon as they got those credits, you would see a $10 billion figure. But it isn't a real figure.
Was it a legitimate question that I asked then?
Yeah.
Could you track that and try to estimate whether or not you had an increasing addiction? In other words, if that number continued to grow, forgetting the revenue, would that indicate that we had more people who were doing more gambling?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, that's difficult because what we do try to track is, are we bringing more people into the equation? And we believe we are with new games. Mm-hmm. And at least the answers that we get from our surveys would suggest that. But it's very difficult to know how much people are betting because they lie to us. The comment about alcohol before about most drunk drives are two beers. I've probably read 30,000 drunk drive reports in my career, and the answer, what were you drinking? Two beers. Well, in gambling, we ask, how much do you bet? $20. Well, if everybody was betting $20, you wouldn't see the revenues that you see. So it's very difficult to know.
But out of the $20, you do get about $11 billion, $5 or $6. That's how much.
Well, you could see what has been growing is the net revenue. Expenses is about the same.
So Oregonians bet $11 billion a year.
Well, that's the machine money, if you will. So if you, let's say, put $10 in the machine and you play a little bit and the machine supposedly gives you some winnings, like $100 a bet, all that dollar churn is that much. But on its own, it's still not a small number. It's about $2 billion. So you have, you could see in percentage wise how the expenses have gone down with the increase of revenue, and how net revenue works in that sense. So if you since the inception of lottery at this time, you could see an explosion in, if you will. This is at the time of the introduction of figure lottery. Percentage-wise, again, that's this is it looks like a vase of a nice-looking vase. It starts with a small stem and gets big. This way. And those are the prizes. Now, yes, we do have an increasing amount of prizes, and prizes are what attracts players to the game.
Is gambling treatment included in the expenses?
Yes, I'll show you what gambling treatment part of is.
I might answer that, Mr. Chair. The expenses actually come out of the transfer, and that's what Mazen is going to next. So it's not counted as our expense at all, but 1% of the transfers goes to treatment. So after those dollars come to the state, that's where that 1% comes.
So it comes out of our revenues, is
yes,
what you're
right.
saying.
Yeah.
So the revenues have stayed flat. The money going into the lottery has skyrocketed. So what did we get out of line games? Doesn't sound like we got much.
We'll come more with the numbers, and you probably would see how we've got quite a bit out of line games. But you see what this purple thing here is what you, as a legislative assembly, used to have what you could appropriate to different programs. That is defined, of course, by the Constitution to be economic development, education, and so on. And then comes, at the time, the Education Stability Fund, and then you have Parks and Recreation, and that
And you would see with the increase of the amounts coming in, the percentages are becoming more and more, and you're having a lot more colors on that line. Mm-hmm. Than, that's how much. That's the sound of 1.3 billion in 07-09. That's a lot.
Size of the kicker.
That's how line games have changed the whole line games have changed the game. And when you have your appropriation amounts that is open for, meaning that is they're not spoken for either by statutes or the Constitution, about 50% of the total. Your Education Stability Fund. When you put these, and I'll explain why the amounts go down a little bit from 18 and 15. But that's how it looks.
So, Mazin, can we spend the last, we got 5 minutes left, just talking retailer compensation rates.
Sure.
I know there's a lot of interest in that, and Dale,
okay.
You can explain how they're...
All right. Retailer compensation, they have changed, basically, and I'll... old rates were... Some people say very generous.
Yeah, no kidding.
And that's how they looked at. Changed those to new rates in 2004 for the poker only with two compensation schemes. Now remember, if you, for example, make $100 million, the first $175,000 would be done on 32.5. The second amount, this amount, will be compensation at 26, and the rest would be over 17%. That gives you an average of about 28.9. Now, with the introduction of the poker and line games, the options are a little different. Okay, that now, of course, we have, and I'll talk about it, coming to reckoning, if you will, with how different levels of compensation that would allow them to target. But this is the last thing I want to say. With the retailer compensation, there is always a debate. Some would say, yeah, gross revenue that is going to come anyhow, and it's going to come all the time. The more you give compensation on this scale, percentage, so if you give 90% compensation, you basically have nothing left. So this space is what the compensation produces. And the more you give, the more you lose. Now, in a different way of looking at revenue, you'd say that it's actually on our curve, and that makes sense because the more work you do, the more you attract your customers and so on, the more revenue goes up. So your expenses actually come, and then there is a point of premium level. You put these two things together, and voila, what you get, intersecting lines. Remember, our profession in economics, we love intersecting lines. We think like we almost see God when we see intersecting lines. So, where are those lines
intersecting? Can you do that drum roll again? Like
So, that is out to the jury. And I'll let Dale talk about it.
Mr. Finn, you got a tough act to follow.
Yeah, I know.
Sound effects with you.
So don't have the sound effects. Four of you have already heard me give a little overview, and I gave you a chart of my handouts, but slide 12 really kind of quickly gives you a snapshot of retailer compensation, if that's the issue you want to talk about. And Mazin has gone over that history, 32% before 2004, new contract in 2004, and these are combined, put all the sales in there, what's the overall blended rate, so 28.5 was the next one, with line games it dropped to 25, then we have this drop that will come about this summer because sales have gone up dramatically, and we have what was a look-back provision that says if sales go beyond 40%, we're going to automatically drop rates again. So that's where that 23% comes in.
So that's
in.
A done deal. That's
the commission would have to vote on that this summer, and really it comes down to on June 30th, they would look at what were our sales, not our projection, but what actually happened. If they are more than $805 million, then they would analyze, is this increase in sales because we greatly increased the number of people selling these games, or is it because sales have increased dramatically? So what's happened now, the December forecast says that our sales in June should be $836 million, obviously far above the 805. And I can tell you that at this point, we have only increased the number of retailers by 4%. So with that analysis, and what I've told retailers and the Restaurant Association, expect that it will happen, but it would require a vote by the commission and that analysis in June.
Thank you.
So,
but doesn't that indicate that you're pretty well in balance as far as compensation? You don't have a lot wanting to come in, but you don't have many leaving also?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, that is one argument that's made about that, and that's certainly one way to analyze it.
Is it possible if the casinos come online just north of Portland, up the gorge, that you'd see a drop in activity at the video poker terminals and line games, and that would then the commission look at that as a possible need to adjust the rates the other direction?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, that's a challenge that I've listed in my materials on the next page here. Not the Gorge Casino, because we have really noticed that within 20 miles of a casino, that is a direct impact to lottery sales. But if you talk about a Le Cinere casino just north, 15 miles north of downtown Portland, yeah, that's going to have an impact. If you're talking about a private Portland casino at the racetrack, yes, that will have an impact. So those are two challenges that are out there that could happen at any time, and so I've tried to list that. But
just another question. The retailers are still required to have lottery sales in their establishment only be a certain percentage of their overall revenue. Isn't that correct? Can you fill in the blank? What's the split?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, it's a rule called dominant use, dominant purpose. I'm actually in the process of reviewing that rule because it started out as a 67% amount that could be gambling revenue, and the rule presently is 60%. I've examined the case very carefully, and I think a single indicator is really not what the court was talking about. The court was talking about, let's look at, we know we can't have 100% as gambling, that is a casino. And they just said, without defining it, we believe that when you get less than 100%, a place whose dominant use and dominant purpose is gambling, that's a casino. They didn't tell us how to define that. So, to me, the real crux here is we are prohibiting casinos. And so what we've said in this new rule is, less than 50%, well, we aren't a casino, so we don't need to worry about them. If their sales are above 50%, well, then we need to look at them. What do they look like? How do they advertise? What products do they sell? What is the sales percentage? And so look at these common sense indicators. And so that's what we've tried to do with the rule. I do believe that it gives us a tool for those places that people might criticize and say, you know, I really can't go in there and buy food, even though they're supposed to be selling food. That gives us, hey, here are these indicators. You need to build up your food account. So I think it will be a good plus for everyone.
And if I just can, I'm sorry, I don't want to monopolize this, but I just have one additional. The Dottie's Delis, in my opinion, they are casinos, but you know, apparently they sell enough something else.
Yeah.
But apparently they're in a transition state. Can you just give us an update about what's happening with that particular?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, that probably is the one group that is criticized maybe not emphasizing food. And I think this new rule will give us that opportunity. However, totally independent of that, I'm a regulator, an enforcer of rules, and one of our rules is that you have to have a particular amount of integrity and reputation, and he got, the owner of Dottie's Deli's got into significant trouble in Nevada. I have revoked his capability to be a contract relationship with Oregon. I have stayed the implication for 60 days on the corporation. He has been removed as an owner or day-to-day operator, and they have inserted another control person. And I expect that by March 3rd, which is that 60-day period, they will have sold. If not, then I'll be faced with terminating the contract. That's the status of it.
How many people walked away from, you know, the great debate a couple of years ago was folks are going to walk away if we significantly lower, and that there was talks of 15-18%. How many retailers ended up leaving in number the line games?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't. We certainly have had people drop business. However, our total amount is about the same, 4% higher. We had a number of people wait to go to line games. For instance, Sherry's organization, they waited about 4 months before they won. Dottie's waited over a year and then sued me on my capability to force that move or to go in that direction. That's still pending. And I believe we'll win that lawsuit. But so we still have 70 operators, even in the face of sales growth dramatically, that have just said, I'm not switching. So I still have 70 operators out of about 2,200 that do poker only.
But they haven't quit the lottery.
No. And
they were saying, we're going to get rid of these machines,
yeah,
which was just ludicrous on the face.
The last thing I could throw...
We gave them a high-end game, though. You know, I think if that hadn't been there, you'd have seen the numbers.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the last thing it's in, the bottom of this page 12 that I wanted to highlight, because it relates to Senator Burdick's comment, is, so what did we get? 2 years ago, as I was sitting here, our number was $770 million. Then the request was we need another $120 million, and when we left the session, the number was about $900 million. And yet you see now that where we're at is we actually produce over $1 billion. This biennium, and then the projection for next biennium is up there to 1.3. So actually, line games produced 120 plus about another $200 million. And I think in this biennium, and I think we got the best of both worlds. We're able to keep coming down on commissions and yet keep a vibrant retailer network and increase our sales and our transfer. So I think it's worked well.
There's similar intersecting lines.
Some studies show, however, that the commissions could go to 15% and still be a very fair rate.
Yeah, my question on the commissions is that purely and solely up to the lottery commission, or does the legislature have the authority statutorily to set commissions?
We could pass a statute, is my understanding. You have a contract.
The Constitution is very clear that the legislature has no impact, no authority over the lottery. The Constitution is very clear. The lottery is completely independent. We can't do diddly squat with it, from my understanding. I mean,
which is it, Dale? I've got
the lottery folks that put the thing on the ballot into the Constitution were very smart and said, we don't want the legislature screwing with our business. So they paid it. They paid to put the constitutional amendment that creates this. I mean, tell me I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader asked me this question in Ways and Means in his particular panel, and I'll answer it the same way. We do have a contract signed until 2010. I do believe that I would have no basis to win a lawsuit if we tried to change commission rates before 2010. The contract did have a clause that allowed for line games to change the contract. Even with that, I got sued. That's the lawsuit I'm talking about. I feel kind of about winning. The other, so I don't think we do have an opportunity until 2010. The second question is, does the legislature have the ability to set rates? I do believe just a conservative answer to that would be it would set up a significant constitutional issue. I would never tell legislators they can't do something, though.
That's how you're smart, but I think we should ask those to the council. I think they'd tell us pretty clearly what the Constitution says.
Well, I understand the contract till 2010, but I wonder what could happen after that.
Yeah, okay. And we do approve. Obviously, the Senate does approve. We just got done doing it or not doing it. New commissioners that the governor appoints.
And that's part of what I tried to put in here. The governor does appoint the director. I serve at his pleasure. I must be confirmed by the Senate. Each commission member must be confirmed by the Senate. So there is that ability to exercise control, and those are set terms.
And I think the Constitution says that the lottery is supposed to maximize return to the state.
For schools
But so don't shoot the goose that lays the golden egg.
Dale always brings a good discussion.
Thank you. Final thought, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Well, we're done with our overviews. This was the last one. So thank you, Matt, and thank you, Dale. Appreciate that. Tomorrow we have a joint committee with the House, an interesting couple economists coming in, one nationally, and Philip Romero to have, a pretty good discussion, two opposite points of view. And is Joe Cotwright going to lead off? He is not.
Are we
here.
Oh, here.
And then next week we'll just start right in on bills. They're piling up on us, and so we'll do a few. Monday, it looks like Monday, we'll just do a few kind of Treasury, other Department of Revenue, and then move into Reserve Fund next week. But we're done with overview, so thank you to the LRO staff for great, concise overviews.
Sometimes even interesting.
Yeah, no, we're 10 minutes over.
This is probably the most entertaining committee I've been in.
That's fun. That's a good idea.
We're